It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, a federal court temporarily blocked President Trump's executive order banning birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented immigrants.
Wisconsin is part of one of the lawsuits seeking to stop the order as it makes its way through the legal system. Trump has already promised to appeal the ruling, and the case is almost certainly heading to the Supreme Court before it's over.
The cases hinge on a part of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins us now with more on the suit. Attorney General Call, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning, Kate and Rob.
What led you to join other states in one of the lawsuits challenging this executive order from the Trump administration?
In any multi-state suit like this, we look at two things fundamentally. Number one, is the policy that's at issue unlawful or otherwise unconstitutional? And number two, does it cause harm to Wisconsinites? And here, both of those tests are easily met. This policy is clearly unconstitutional. You just read the clear language of the 14th Amendment, which prohibits the kind of action the Trump administration is taking. On top of that, there are Supreme Court opinions interpreting that language that are inconsistent with the Trump administration's position. And there's federal law that provides that kids who are born in the U.S. are citizens. So the Trump administration is clearly acting unconstitutionally and unlawfully. And in doing so, they're taking a fundamental right away from kids who are born in Wisconsin and other states, which is United States citizenship. So we have taken action here to protect the rights of those kids who will be born in Wisconsin.
Let's dig into both parts of your argument there. The constitutionality, first of all, as you mentioned, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in 1898 with the interpretation that we've been using up until this point. There's been an argument in some conservative legal circles that the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof, saying, OK, if there's somebody here, they're undocumented. Well, they're subject to the jurisdiction of their home country. They're not complete subjects of the United States. Therefore, that part of the 14th Amendment doesn't apply to them. Therefore, their kids born here shouldn't be citizens. What do you say to that argument?
Well, that argument is inconsistent with over 100 years of U.S. Supreme Court precedent. It's also inconsistent with the history of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was passed in response to the Dred Scott decision, which is widely considered to be the worst, or at least one of the worst decisions in U.S. history. And it contradicted a longstanding principle that there was natural-born citizenship in the U.S. The 14th Amendment specifically reversed that with this very clear language. And the reality is that kids who are born in the U.S. are subject to the jurisdiction of this country. They can be subject to legal proceedings. So that notion that they're not subject to the jurisdiction just doesn't hold up. And again, it's inconsistent with the U.S. Supreme Court precedent. If the president wants to take an action that's inconsistent with the Constitution, the process for that is to amend the Constitution. What you have here instead is Donald Trump and his administration trying to place themselves above the Constitution and above the law. And that's just not how our system of government works.
And you mentioned that two-part test to join a lawsuit, the constitutionality, and then the harm done to the state. And of course, a court, we've seen this again and again, might say, hey, your lawsuit might be valid, it might not be, but you don't have standing, there hasn't been harm to you. What would be the harm to Wisconsin that would make a court take a challenge from Wisconsin seriously?
Well, because of these proposed changes from the Trump administration, if they were to go into effect, there would be a number of changes that Wisconsin would have to make to programs that are already in place. For example, right now, if a child is born in the U.S., we can safely assume that that child is a citizen. This would require us to set up a whole apparatus for determining whether somebody is a citizen and in turn whether they're eligible for various programs in the United States. So the states would have to put in place a new system and spend resources making these assessments. So there would be costs to states around the country. They're also essentially requiring, if this goes into effect, that agents of the federal government and the states take actions that are unconstitutional and unlawful. So by pushing back against this, we're working to ensure that people's rights are protected, but also to ensure that our Constitution and federal law are being followed.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is with us looking at a lawsuit challenging a Trump administration order on so-called birthright citizenship. Now, the current state of affairs, another lawsuit, this one brought mainly by, a few Western states and a couple others. A judge appointed by Republican Ronald Reagan put a hold on it. He said, quote, this is a blatantly unconstitutional order, and said, I have difficulty understanding how a member of the bar would state unequivocally that this is a constitutional order. It just boggles my mind. So it's on hold for now. That's not the end of the road for that challenge or this one. What is next?
Well, first, I think it's important to just emphasize what you read there from the judge's decision. This is blatantly unconstitutional, and it boggles the mind that an attorney could take this position. And that's a judge appointed by President Ronald Reagan, not exactly a left-wing president. So that shows how extreme this policy is. Now, in our case, we will be seeking an order just like was issued in the other case, blocking this from going into effect. If that order is issued, then there's a high chance that this will go through the appeals process. And whether it gets to the courts of appeals or ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court will depend on how litigation proceeds. I'm very optimistic, though, that we will get an order blocking this from going into effect because it is so obviously unconstitutional. But that process will play out over the next several weeks initially, and then probably months or years before we get final resolution.
The U.S. Supreme Court in recent years has shown itself open to changing past court precedent, the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade, the most notable but not only example. Do you have a concern that if it does reach the U.S. Supreme Court, they might go back and say, no, the Supreme Court in 1898 got this completely wrong?
Well, I think that's part of what's going on here with what the Trump administration has done. It's trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to fundamentally change the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. But the language of the Constitution, again, is perfectly clear. The 14th Amendment says that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So I don't think we're going to see the U.S. Supreme Court go so far as to ignore the clear language of the U.S. Constitution. And it's important to note, too, that this is a real challenge to the authority of the courts, because what the Trump administration is saying here is that despite what the Constitution says, despite what federal law says, and despite what U.S. Supreme Court precedent says, we're going to ignore all of that and decide that the law means something different based on our own unprecedented, really, interpretation of the law. So I'm hopeful that we will see the court step in, but this will be a key test of how the courts are going to respond to the Trump administration.
This is just one of many executive orders from the new administration when it comes to immigration. There have been concerns over an order saying, hey, Department of Justice, if, in our view, local government officials don't cooperate with immigration enforcement actions, well, we should investigate them. They could be liable. As the state's top attorney, what kind of things are you watching for as we see immigration efforts stepped up under new rules and guidelines?
Well, first, with respect to that memo, we'll see how that's ultimately interpreted. But again, there is clear precedent that states have the right to make their own decisions about their own policies. There is U.S. Supreme Court precedent preventing the federal government from doing what's called commandeering, essentially requiring states to be part of federal efforts. That doesn't mean that if there are ways that there can be cooperation, we're not open to figuring out how we can work with the federal government, say, to reduce the cost of goods or on public safety issues. But to threaten state and local officials is not the way that you build stronger enforcement of our laws. It's a way to undermine cooperation, which is at the key of this. I think it's also notable that we're seeing all this happening, just within a week of when Donald Trump pardoned over 1,500 people who were involved in the events of January 6th. That includes people who committed violent crimes against police officers. And so what Donald Trump did there was he sided with people who committed those crimes over law enforcement officers. So this is a pattern of disregarding the courts. Now, there, the president did have the authority. He does have pardon authority. But overall, we've seen a pattern of disregarding the rule of law and disregarding the courts. And that's a really concerning sign for the direction that this administration is taking.
In our last minute, are there pieces of a federal immigration enforcement where you see room for cooperation at the state level and from local law enforcement in Wisconsin?
Well, we approach things at the Department of Justice, and I know that police chiefs and sheriffs approach things in a similar way. based on what's in the best interest of public safety. And if there is an investigation that leads to the arrest of somebody who is in the country illegally and they're subsequently deported following a significant criminal offense, that's part of our system of justice. And that's how things have worked for years. So there certainly is room for joint investigations. What's concerning to me about what we've seen from the Trump administration is they've rescinded policies, for example, that prevent immigration enforcement at schools or churches. So they may be going into these very sensitive places. There's also concern in Wisconsin that their policies could have a huge detrimental impact on our agricultural industry. So we will assess any particular issue based on the facts of the case. And our lodestar is always going to be making sure that we're taking steps in the best interest of public safety.
Just briefly, if a school administrator, a farm operator, whoever has questions about law enforcement, are worried about what kind of enforcement operations they could see, is the state's Department of Justice a resource where they can reach out and at least get questions answered over what they do and don't have to do?
Statutorily, we don't provide legal advice to individuals, but I do think it's important for various entities to provide general information about what the laws provide. We expect to be putting out some information, and I know that others have been as well. But fundamentally, it's important for folks to know their rights and to take action accordingly.
Attorney General Call, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is Wisconsin's attorney general. Wisconsin is part of a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration over its executive order on birthright citizenship. If you have questions you'd like to get answered, perhaps in a future conversation or maybe by our news team, when it comes to immigration, enforcement, and changes under the new presidential administration, let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, with a nationwide shortage of medical examiners who investigate causes of death, the head of Wisconsin's Professional Association shares why this work is a calling.
When I die, I want somebody to respect me, and I want somebody to cover me up, and I want somebody to take care of me for my family.
That conversation is ahead on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On Thursday, President Trump ordered a pause on a number of programs that allow people to come into the country temporarily.
One of those programs, Uniting for Ukraine, has allowed over 150,000 Ukrainians to settle in the U.S. since Russia's 2022 invasion. Colleen Leahy spoke with one Ukrainian in Wisconsin about her experience.
It's 12:30 p.m. on a Monday. Time for the Winnebago Area Literacy Council's More English class. 14 students listen as teacher Jean Kyler gives a lesson on nouns. As part of the lesson, Kyler lists just some of the places her students are from.
Everybody has a different country. Mexico, Turkey, Nicaragua, Venezuela. Those are the proper nouns. The common noun is country.
Elena Kachenko has been learning English at the Literacy Council for a year and a half.
My name is Elena. My surname is Tkachenko. I'm from Ukraine.
Kachenko came to OMRO 2 years ago through the Uniting for Ukraine program, which is also called U4U. U4U was created under President Joe Biden, so there would be an easier way for Ukrainians displaced by the war to settle and work temporarily in the U.S. On Thursday, Trump ordered a pause to the U4U program, stopping any final decisions on applications. Kachenko's journey from Ukraine to the U.S. has been incredibly challenging.
Ну, їжала я, конечно, очень тяжело було. под обстрелами.
It was really hard to leave my homeland. So there was bombing going everywhere. It was terrible.
Мы когда приехали.
So after our neighborhood and my house were bombed and pretty much deteriorated to the ground, so we first arrived into the refugee camp in Spain. So my daughter had immigrated in the United States earlier because she married an American citizen, and then I was able to join them like on the family reunification case. It was really heartbreaking to leave my homeland because I lived there for 55 years of my life. So leaving everything behind was heartbreaking.
Trump's immigration policies are affecting so many different groups of people that it's less about Ukrainians specifically and more about overhauling the immigration system as a whole. That's according to Yoshiko Herrera, a professor of political science at UW-Madison and an expert on Russia.
There's nothing from the Trump administration so far that says they're particularly targeting Ukrainians, like that Ukrainians are the reason for the end of these programs. I think it's more that they're particularly targeting people from Mexico, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Haiti.
So why stop a program that has helped over 150,000 Ukrainians come to the U.S.?
I think they wanted to show that they were acting quickly on immigration right from the start. So my sense is that they just are like, okay, we're pausing everything. But I wouldn't be surprised if they, you know, in the next couple of weeks decide, oh, well, okay, that United for Ukraine is okay. I mean, the sense I get is that it's just a blanket order and that it's going to be sorted out later.
Kachenko's application to extend her U for U visa was approved, but only through April. She says it's been hard to adjust to life in Wisconsin, but she's also found a lot of support here.
So having come to Wisconsin, it just feels so peaceful after those years of living, you know, under the threat of bombing, you know, every night, and the tragedy of the whole nation. I also find the citizens of this country very friendly, very supportive. Whoever I reach out to always lend me a helping hand.
Kachenko hopes to stay in the U.S. permanently to keep building her life here and because she has no family left in Ukraine to go back to. Colleen Leahy, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Special thanks to Oksana Martinova-Prezentka for translating.
Medical examiner and coroner offices play a critical role in communities as they help to identify causes of death.
But according to a recent report by the National Institute of Justice, more than 2,000 of these offices around the country struggle with chronic funding issues, staff shortages, and outdated equipment.
To look at how this issue is affecting our state, we turn to the president of the Wisconsin Coroners and Medical Examiners Association.
Crystal Schaub is chief medical examiner for Oneida, Vilas, and Forest counties in the northernmost parts of Wisconsin. Crystal, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
There's this chronic shortage of staff and funding in medical examiner and coroner offices around the country. Are you having to rely on coroner offices around you if you need help, or what are the protocols?
Well, we don't have people lined up at the doors wanting to do this particular job. And I don't know if it's the fear behind dead bodies or, you know, I don't know what that stigma is there. You have to be a special kind of person to work in this field. You're called out late at nights. You could be stuck on a scene for hours. Middle of the woods, it's cold, it's wet, it's just really kind of miserable conditions out there. So I do understand that. We do feel the pressure somewhat up here. Out of the 72 counties that we have in Wisconsin, they're all feeling the pressure of lack of staff for the same reason. We do have mutual aid agreements with all of our surrounding counties and as far down as even Marathon County. And we've had a couple of times, not many, but just a couple that surrounding agencies have asked us for help because they're short-staffed as well. We thankfully have never had to ask for that mutual aid agreement because we've had staff that was readily available to go help with those calls. But people really just don't want to do this job.
What is the toll on you in this job, and what was your pathway into it?
I have 18 years of prior law enforcement experience, and I was just ready to just find a different path in life. And I did a lot of death investigations when I was part of the patrol units, and I had a conversation with the past medical examiner. I had asked him how I could do his job. You know, would you hire me? I'm really interested in this field. And, you know, I like the puzzle work. And so he hired me part-time. And then officially January of 2019, I took over as the chief medical examiner. So I don't have any medical background. Everything that I learned was on the job training. I send my staff to annual trainings, conferences, anything that I can find that's within my budget to send them to, because I feel like you're not going to get better if you don't learn, and you need to keep those skills up. And training is such an important part of our positions.
You mentioned Marathon County, which is set to revamp their medical examiner's office. They have a new building opening in 2025. It will be much more state-of-the-art, and they're recruiting a physician to be their forensic pathologist. What impact do you think that will have? Will you be able to send autopsies there in Marathon County?
Yes, absolutely. We typically do our autopsies right down at UW-Madison, the forensic pathology department. Sometimes, just depending upon how busy they are, we may use Fond du Lac. I've already talked to the chief medical examiner down there in Marathon County. And so she's been working on this program for such a long time, many years, and little bits of funding here and there. And so she's all set to move forward. And I think they have a tentative open date of July of 2025. And we're really excited for her because she could literally service the entire northern part of Wisconsin, which is quite a few counties. And then, of course, her surrounding counties. And with the lack of facilities to do the autopsies, this is a game changer for us. It would take us an hour to get there versus 3+ hours to have to drive to Madison or Fond du Lac. If we sent somebody to Madison or Fond du Lac to do the autopsy, they're out an entire day. And we don't have the staff to be able to do that anymore. So we could drive a patient down, get the autopsy done. We could even drive them down, drop them off, and come back and get them. It's going to be a huge game changer for us.
Crystal Schaub is with us, Chief Medical Examiner for Oneida, Forest, and Vilas counties in the northernmost parts of the state as we talk about Wisconsin death investigation practices. Crystal, the publication Forensic said New Mexico is pioneering the use of CT scans to reduce autopsy numbers and to help lower costs. Is Wisconsin doing things like this to streamline death investigations and lower costs through technology?
Yes. In fact, Patty Schachner, she was a state representative for quite a few years, and she saw the need, and she was able to apply for grants to get a CT scanner for her office. And so now we have this newer technology coming out. It's called Randox. So the coroner's medical examiners can apply for funding, and they can get these machines that you obtain a sample, a toxicology sample from the patient, and you can run it through this machine, and you get an idea of what drugs they have in their system within 20 minutes. Versus us taking a sample, sending it out to the lab, and now we're waiting on weeks to get that result back. And to have those kind of technologies available to us, you can't even put a dollar amount on that, but it comes down to funding, which a lot of us counties, we just don't have.
And that is happening in St. Croix County, where Patty Schachner is a chief medical examiner. ProPublica recently published the story saying that a sudden death of a baby in Idaho went uninvestigated, and national guidelines suggest taking investigated steps in cases like this. But Idaho state law didn't require any. What would Wisconsin have done differently in a situation like this?
So we don't critique how other people do their jobs. There are different rules. There's different laws amongst all of our states and different guidelines, of course. But I can tell you what we would have done differently based on our laws. And an infant would have went for autopsy. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. That would have happened here. We would have done a full scene investigation according to our guidelines. We would have done the doll reenactment with the family, which we, that is a common practice for us.
What does that mean?
So a doll reenactment is when you, it basically looks like a doll. It doesn't have a face. It doesn't have genitalia, no identifying. It looks like a stuffed beanbag is what it, we're trying to make the families not have to relive every aspect. And if they look at a doll that's got a face, it just really hurts them. Mm-hmm. So this doll is a beanbag in the shape of a body, and we give it to the last person that was with that child. They will take the doll and show us where they were laying in bed. How was the doll laying? You know, what did they do throughout the day or the hours up to the death? And more times than any, that event that led up to that death never leaves the mind of the person that was last with them. It could be a couple hours, it could be a couple of days, it could be a couple of weeks, but we can get so many more details doing the doll reenactment because the person will be able to say, I was laying here, this is how my baby was laying. And then I got up and I put the baby over here and I covered, and they literally will relive every single action that they did. Mm-hmm. And it is so helpful from an investigative standpoint to be able to actually see them doing these actions.
Wow, that's really interesting. Are there other strategies or tactics to help you in this work to better understand how a death occurred? Because you call this work a puzzle work.
It is. Every death is a puzzle. It's up to us to figure out how and why they died. And our strategy going into every single scene is we have to treat it like it's a homicide, and then we downgrade. And that is so we don't miss anything. And we always work with law enforcement. Law enforcement is always present at the scene. We'll talk, we share notes, taking pictures. Sometimes we'll take pictures of all the rooms in the house, not just where the patient is located. We do external exam on the patient, look for any kind of signs of injury, trauma, and try to determine what happened to this person.
Hmm. You call this person a patient, although they are deceased?
Correct. This is my opinion, and I don't know how other medical examiners address their patients. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are deceased. Yes, they are a decedent. Legally, that's what their name is because they are no longer with us. If I call them deceased or a decedent to the family, they're already in so much pain, so much pain. We like to call the person by their name to the family. A patient is more sterile versus dead body, deceased, mm-hmm. deceased, that it's just so final to them, mm-hmm. and it hurts them. We have seen the reaction come from families. And I said, you know, we need to kind of relook at this.
It seems like in so many aspects of your work, you're trying to limit the trauma, contain the trauma, and be really attentive to what these families are facing in that moment.
We try. You know, every person is different. Every family is different. There's never a duplicate encounter. Everybody deals with trauma their own way. And there's a lot of people out there, you know, and I'm talking people in their 40s, 50s, 60s who have never seen a dead body, never. And this could be the most traumatic thing that has ever happened to them. And myself, I've dealt with death my whole life. I've lost lots of family members. I remember seeing dead bodies when I was a little child. You know, I lost a sibling in my home when I was 5, and I remember that. And I know that everything I say to them and everything I do to them, they're going to associate that and they're going to remember that. And we want them to go to the next phase of grief as easily as possible. And we sit with them and we talk and we listen to the stories, and the stories are just amazing and heartfelt. And I can't even really put words to the stories that the families tell us about their loved ones. That's important to them. If it's important to them, it's important to me.
I wonder, as we close, how would you like to make your mark on the Wisconsin Coroners and Medical Examiners Association in your term as president?
The simplest answer that I can come up with is unity. You know, we have such a great working relationship with all of our counties right now, and that's been going on for probably decades. And I would like to see that continue. And by keeping that unity together, you expand it. And I'm just going to tell you a story. When I first started doing this job, the chief medical examiner asked me, he said, "Why do you want to do this job?" My heart told me at that moment, the reason I wanted to do this was to shield people. And that's what we did in law enforcement. We shielded people. We keep the monsters at bay. And the citizens in the community, they don't see the monsters like we see the monsters. And when I die, I want somebody to respect me, and I want somebody to cover me up, and I want somebody to take care of me for my family. And that was what I incorporated when I first took over this office, is we need to shield these families from all the nastiness. And they already are traumatized because they lost their loved one. Let's show the patient the dignity that they deserve. And if you do it a couple of times, it becomes a habit. And now, not only are we doing it, we're seeing law enforcement doing it. Law enforcement sees how we do our job, and they will do exactly what we do. And that's the point I'm trying to make. People see what we do, and it's a habit. It becomes a habit for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's what I want.
Crystal, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Crystal Schwab is chief medical examiner for Oneida, Vilas, and Forest Counties and serves as president of the Wisconsin Coroners and Medical Examiners Association. We have been talking about a national shortage of staff in these offices around and around the country.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a group in Racine gets together to draw pictures of the world around them and gain a new appreciation of their local community.
You really, really, really see the world in a different way by becoming an urban sketcher.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of art making is a solo activity, but for the global organization Urban Sketchers, it's all about what and who you're surrounded by.
Here in Wisconsin and around the world, urban sketching groups bring people together to draw and paint pictures of the world around them, regardless of their artistic skill levels.
Kathy Wilson is the former executive director of the Racine Arts Council and the founder and current leader of Racine's Urban Sketching Chapter, one of four chapters in Wisconsin. She's here to tell us about what she calls her great passion. Kathy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Give us the basics, please. What do urban sketchers do?
Well, the main thing urban sketchers do is we sketch on location. So our whole goal is to be somewhere, wherever that is in the world, find an interesting scene, people, coffee shop, boat, whatever, and we sketch right on location. So we bring all of our tools with us, we haul all our stuff out, and just start doing our work.
Where did you first encounter urban sketching?
Well, it's interesting because I've been a three-dimensional artist my whole life and never wanted to do anything two-dimensional. And so I was at the Holland Tulip Festival a couple of years ago, and I saw this woman sitting under a tree with her bicycle, and I went up to her and I said, "Are you plein air painting?" which is painting on location. Mm-hmm. She said, "No, I'm urban sketching." And I said, "What is urban sketching?" And so she showed me her book, her sketchbook. She showed me her tiny little watercolor palette. And she was completely self-contained, sketching these beautiful tulips. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Because this was really, really exciting to see. And that was the start of it for me.
And this is an international organization that you've helped to promote here in Wisconsin. Talk a little bit, please, about the goals of Urban Sketchers as an international movement.
Well, Urban Sketchers Global has 439 chapters in the world. So anywhere you go in the world, you can travel and you can send a Facebook post and you can either join the event that they're doing around the world, or you can maybe say, I'm coming to travel to Fort Lauderdale or Greece or wherever, and there'll be a sketcher there that will want to meet with you. When I decided to pique my interest in all of this sketching, I thought, I can go to Chicago to sketch because there's a beautiful sketch group there. I can go to Milwaukee. I can go to Madison. But I want to do it in my own hometown. And so I started Urban Sketchers Racine. So we've been an official chapter for over a year now.
What was the response when you started spreading the word in Racine about bringing this group together?
People were so excited because they want to sketch right where we live. They don't. We love to go to Chicago, but we don't want to have to go to Chicago to meet other sketchers. And sketchers love to be together. The joy for us is not only sketching something, so we're doing our artwork, but we really love adventure. We love to travel. We love to spend social time with each other. So sometimes we'll have lunch and we'll sketch together. Sometimes we'll meet at the lighthouse or the beach and we'll sketch together. But it's just a real joy to be together. That's really the main goal.
And I wanted to ask about that group element of it, because in my head, you know, drawing, painting, sketching, whatever is a solo activity. Even if you're in a class, well, everybody's kind of doing their own thing. Why is that communal part of it, that group part of it, so important to the experience?
You know, I don't really know. I just know that when you are together, you're sharing your passion, and there is absolutely no judgment in this particular art form. You can have somebody that's as experienced as a degree in art, or you can have somebody that's a brand new sketcher, and everybody is so glad you're there. They're so glad you're sharing. They're so glad you're learning. And then when you're done with your group effort, we put all of our sketchbooks down on a table or the ground, and we call it a throwdown. And so if there's 15 people, there's 15 sketchbooks on the ground. We're looking at all the work. Then we pick them up when we all hold them and we take a group shot so that you can see that we're together. And the smiles on people's faces is what's so fun to see.
I wanted to ask you about that, the quality, because I'm somebody, if I really put my mind to it and concentrate and do a drawing, I can come up with something pretty mediocre, right? And I would be a little shy, I think, about getting together with a group of people that almost certainly includes better artists than me. Encourage those people who don't think of themselves as artists, who don't think they're, you know, capable of doing something high quality, to still check this out.
Well, that's the interesting thing about it, because when I started, I was not a two-dimensional artist, and I've never wanted to draw in my whole life. Like you, Rob, I had no intention of drawing. I could do a stick figure, but I began to do it, and I began to be encouraged by the people that were there. I'm very serious when I say there is no judgment in urban sketching. Everybody there is so excited that you've come. It's exciting to have you there and meet you and talk with you, but it's also exciting that you're wanting to try. And I just talked to somebody this weekend in Minneapolis, and she is an artist, and she was deathly afraid to sketch. She brought all of her things with her. She was with a group of 30 people. She did not sketch. She did not put anything down. She was standing right in front of me when we were looking at all of the sketches, and she was so interested in learning it. And I said, don't be afraid. Just come. Just do it. Just put your thing down the first time. And if you come and you don't want to put it down in the throwdown, don't. I mean, that's the thing. There's zero judgment in urban sketching. There's just excitement and encouragement.
Can you talk a little bit about the people who show up at urban sketching events in Racine? Anybody could try drawing from any walk of life, I imagine. You get a pretty big variety of people showing up.
We do. We have people that are young. We have people that are retired. Lots of retired people sketch, because a lot of sketch events are during the week. Usually the big chapters will have one sketch event a month, and that usually will attract, in our area, we attract maybe 15 people. In the big cities, they'll attract 80 people or 35 people. And it's all walks of life. I mean, I've got four sketching friends that are architects, and they are so encouraging to everybody, and we can all learn from them. Then I have friends that are sketchers that are Oh, geez, all walks of life. They don't have anything to do with art. It's just their passion. So they come and they share.
We are talking about urban sketching with Kathy Wilson, leader of Racine's Urban Sketching Group. I understand there are 4 official urban sketching groups in Wisconsin, and given the numbers you mentioned, that's pretty impressive. Are you in contact? Do you people in different Wisconsin communities kind of trade back and forth at your events?
Always. That's part of the fun. I was just in Minneapolis, and I was at Urban Sketchers Twin Cities, but I have visited Urban Sketchers Chippewa Valley, Urban Sketchers Madison. I heard just today that Green Bay is looking into getting an official chapter there. So it's a growing thing because there's so much fun in this and so much joy.
How do you choose what you're going to get together and draw? Because when I've looked at examples, sometimes it's, you know, a scenic vista maybe, but sometimes it's, you know, people's plates at a coffee shop or something like that. It doesn't have to be something fantastically visually appealing to have fun drawing it.
That's very true. Wintertime, there's a lot of coffee shop sketching going on. It's fun to sketch in a coffee shop because you can sketch people. You can sketch your donut or your croissant. You can sketch your shoe if your legs are crossed. You can sketch groups of people that are sitting at the coffee shop. That's the thing. Sketching is whatever you want to sketch and wherever you are. It's just fun to do it. You learn something every time you sketch. Sometimes you're sketching perspective, so you're sketching buildings. Sometimes you're sketching landscapes and you're sketching lake views or sunrise or sunsets. In Chicago, it's very fun. We go down and we sketch the Bean. Here in Racine, we've sketched the lighthouse. We've sketched the Dekoven Center. We've sketched the beach. We've sketched the Main Street Bridge. I mean, it's just all kinds of things. It doesn't make any difference. It's all fun to do.
Now, what I think about a lot when I read about urban sketching and I look at the work people are doing, you know, it's easy. We see something cool. Many of us have a phone in our pocket with a camera on it. We might take a quick picture, maybe share it with somebody else. But when you're sketching something, you're really focusing on it for a while. You're focusing your mind and your attention on it. Does that make you see the world differently?
Oh, my gosh. I see the world completely different since I've been a sketcher. And I'm a photographer. I'm an artist. And so I've always seen the world through a different lens. But when I started sketching, now I see, oh, geez, look how that chimney is attached to that roof. Look at that tree, really. I mean, look at the branches and where they start. Look at the shape of your foot. I mean, a sketch and a drawing I've learned as I've done this is just, it's just lines and it's just shapes. So if you're thinking about that, you really, really, really see the world in a different way by becoming an urban sketcher.
Okay, and does that translate over, you're just going for a walk maybe or a drive and you're not sketching, do you still kind of have that eye for the world?
Every time I'm out and about, I am looking at how can I sketch that now? I see everything different, no matter where I am, what time of the day. It's how I see the world now because I've become a sketcher. I see things completely different.
And do you carry around some kind of sketch pad or something and maybe have moments outside of those monthly events where you're like, yeah, I got a few minutes. I'm going to sketch whatever.
I sketch every day. I have my pack with me every day. It's in my car. The other day I was just driving down the street and I saw this Episcopal church that the steeple was just so gorgeous. And I just pulled over in the parking lane and I just took 20 minutes and I sketched it. My watercolor was with me. I put it down and in 20 minutes I had something done.
Now you've mentioned you're a 3D artist. I imagine that includes a sculpture of some sort. Does sketching change your eye for the 3D art you do?
Ooh, that's not a question I've ever even thought about. The funny thing is I haven't been doing any three-dimensional art since I've been become a sketcher. That's what I do.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so that's that. So this is something that satisfies the artistic urge.
Totally, totally. It's so self-contained that everything is in my backpack. My Micron pens are there. My watercolor. I've got a little bottle of water there that I carry with me. My sketchbook is there. You know, if you're a three-dimensional artist, you have to carry lots of stuff. If you make pottery, you have to have clay and water and a mess. I'm a jewelry maker, and so I would have to carry beads with me. And, you know, I can do that, but sketching is just a different ballgame.
Now, you've mentioned meeting up with people in the Chippewa Valley and Madison groups, Twin Cities groups, and others. If and when you travel, do you try to build in a meetup with that local urban sketcher group if you're able to do that?
Absolutely. I was in Minneapolis this weekend to see my brother, who lives there. He's an architectural blacksmith. And I went to the sketch event. It was at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. And so I sketched with 35 to 40 people there. And then I called another sketch friend who was an architect. And I went to his studio for the first time so I could see all of his sketches. And we talked. And yes, I mean, you just make amazing friends in this world.
You mentioned gear and how easy it is. Like, literally, I could have a notepad and a number two pencil if I wanted. What have you gravitated toward when it comes to what you want to sketch with?
Definitely watercolor. Mm-hmm. You can have a water palette box in your kit that is maybe 3 inches by 4 inches and have 12 colors in there. So you can get a water brush pen. So it's a paintbrush, but it's got a small tube of water attached to it.
Huh.
So you don't even have to carry water with you. Although I do, you can always just use this brush. So you have your watercolor, your brush, and your sketchbook, and that's all you need.
You mentioned earlier Green Bay is maybe on the road to adding yet another urban sketch or group to Wisconsin. If somebody's listening in a community out there that doesn't have one yet and they're thinking, hey, this is super cool, what goes into getting something like this started?
The main thing is to go to the Urban Sketchers website, which is urbansketchers.org. And it's a fabulous website. It will guide you right to the place that says start a chapter. And then there are people that are volunteers there that will help guide you. The person that guided me, her name is Mary Jo Ernst, and she is in Michigan. And she used to be with the Chicago Sketch Group. I connected with her, and she guided me through every single step to become an official chapter.
You mentioned that, you know, there's no judgment here as far as quality from one person to another. That said, have you taken some of your watercolor sketches and said, hey, I really like this one? And maybe that goes up, on the wall or at least the refrigerator at home?
I definitely do that. I've made cards out of them. I'm selling them in some stores, some coffee shops. I send them as postcards to friends. Sometimes when you sketch, you want to give that person the sketch that you just did. And there's no greater joy. I was down in Key West, and I was at an outdoor restaurant, and there was an oyster shucker, and I showed him the sketch at the end, and he said, can I have this?
Oh.
And I said, unfortunately, it's in my sketchbook, but I came home, I made a postcard, and I mailed it to him.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, and the amazing, getting back to the social element, I mean, you're meeting people who you become acquaintances with, maybe friends with once a month. How much has this expanded the circle of people in your artistic and personal circle?
I'm astounded by what has happened in the last 3 years for me. The friends that I have now are actually more like family. I see them a lot. We text a lot. We Facebook and share a lot. Because there's no judgment, there's a lot of conversation that also goes in it while you're sitting there for 2 hours sketching with somebody. So you're at a coffee shop, you're enjoying that part of it. It's amazing the closeness of the friends that I have found in the sketch world in such a short period of time.
That's fantastic. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I really enjoyed this.
Kathy Wilson is the leader of an urban sketching group in Racine, one of 4 urban sketcher groups around Wisconsin.
Keep an eye on trends here at Wisconsin Today. And in coming shows, we're going to look into how Wisconsin and the Midwest are heating up to sauna culture. You got to inject a little pun in there, Rob.
And do you get fired up over the Nordic custom of saunas? Have you tried out public saunas? If so, where? What's the experience like with the heat and the steam and the tending to a fire?
Up in Duluth, you can board a barge in the harbor for a floating sauna and then take a plunge into Lake Superior.
Share your thoughts, your experiences with sauna culture wherever you are. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
You can also leave us a message or text about how you became a sauna enthusiast, especially on those negative degree days. The number is 888-642.
Zero two three two. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.